Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show, coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas, gateway to the Old West, the most haunted city in the country. Well, news has been interesting. If you want comic relief, watch what goes on in Congress. People who are elected to legislate are wanting to spend their time running around like something crazy to investigate. And most of them, if they found what they were looking for, wouldn't know what it was. About half of them couldn't find their rear end with both hands in a flashlight. Well, last night when we had to leave, we were talking about Walt Disney and the CIA. A secret connection. Now, Ward Kimball, a major player in the Walt Disney Corporation, was famous for his on-screen animation. He created the Cheshire Cat, Jiminy Cricket, the March Hare, and the Mad Hatter. Mad Hatter went on, interestingly enough, to become Member of Congress. Not only that, Kimball was the man responsible for Mickey Mouse, at least the current incarnation. Joined Disney Studios in 1934 and went up the ranks to become a directing animator in such classics as Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, Pinocchio, Fantasia, Peter Pan. Directed Disney's Oscar-winning shorts, Toot, Whistle, Plunk and Boom, in 1953, and It's Tough to Be a Bird in 1969. But as strange as it might seem, in the early 50s, Walt Disney, Kimball, and senior elements of the CIA were all tied together in a secret program to influence public opinion on the nature of UFOs. So, let's look at this odd relationship. First thing that jumps out is the time frame. Now, on both July 19th and 20th, 1952, there were repeated sightings of unknown aerial objects in the Washington, D.C. airspace. Something that on July 24th led Air Force Major General John Samford to state in a secret memorandum for the attention of the Deputy Chief of Staff of Fire Operations, "We are interested in these reports and that we must always be on the alert for any threat or indication of a threat to the United States. We can't ignore these reports, but the mild hysteria subsequent to publicity given the subject causes an influx of reports, which since the 19th of July have almost saturated our emergency procedures. Now, the situation really escalated over the weekend of July 26th and 27th. A two-page Air Force document prepared only days later, made available through the Freedom of Information Act, stated this incident involved unidentified targets observed on the radar scopes at the Air Route Traffic Control Center in the tower, both at Washington National Airport and the Approach Control Radar at Andrews Air Force Base. In addition, visual observations were reported to Andrews and Bowling Air Force Base and to the ARTC Center, the latter by pilots of commercial aircraft and one CAA aircraft. Varying numbers of up to 12 simultaneously of unidentified targets on the ARTC radar scope. Termed by CAA personnel as generally solid return, similar to AC except slower. Mr. Bill Shreve, flying ACNC 12, reported at 2246. It visually spotted five objects giving off a light glow ranging from orange to white. Although the portions extracted from this report speak for themselves, we do have an official transcript of a conversation dated July 26 between staff at Washington National Airport and personnel from Andrews Air Force Base at the time of the sightings. From Washington National, Andrews Tower, do you read? Do you have an airplane in sight west, northwest, or east of your airport, eastbound? From Andrews, came the response, no, but we just got a call from the center. We're looking at it. Washington, we got a big target showing up on our scope. He's just coming in on the west edge of your airport. He'll be passing right through the northern portion of your field on an east heading, about a quarter of a mile from the northwest runway. Andrews. This is Andrews. Our radar tracker said he's got a big fat target out here, both west of Andrews. He's got two more south of the field. Washington. Yes, well, the center has about four or five around Andrews' range station. Center's working in National Airlines. The center's working him and vectoring him around his target. Well, within a matter of hours of hearing of the events on July 26th and 7th, J. Edgar Hoover instructed N.W. Philcox, the FBI's Air Force liaison, to determine what had taken place and get the Air Force opinion on the UFO subject as a whole. The Air Force declassified, the FBI declassified the UFO files in which this extract was taken. On July 29th, Philcox made arrangements with the Director of Air Intelligence, Major General John Sanford, to meet with Commander Randall Boyd of the current intelligence branch, Estimates Division, Air Intelligence, regarding the present status of air intelligence research and the numerous reports regarding flying saucers and flying discs. And although the Air Force was publicly playing down the possibility UFOs or anything truly extraordinary, Philcox was advised that at the present time, the Air Force has failed to arrive at any satisfactory conclusion in its research regarding numerous reports of flying saucers and flying disc. Philcox was further informed the Air Intelligence had set up at Wright-Patterson the Air Technical Intelligence Center, which had been established in part for the purpose of coordinating, relating, and making research into all reports regarding flying saucers and flying disc. Well, the interesting thing was, while they're lying to the public that there's nothing to it, and anybody that says they see a UFO is crazy, they're jumping through their hats trying to figure out what's going on. And during this meeting between Boyd and Philcox, Philcox noted in his report that Boyd advised it's not entirely impossible the objects may possibly be ships from another planet such as Mars. At the very same time, they are telling the American people it's swamp gas. Now, the events of July of 1952 deeply troubled the FBI and the Air Force. They're greatly worried the CIA as well, and very intriguing alternative reasons that had very little to do with literal alien invasion or visitation. According to CIA's Assistant Director, H. Marshall Chadwell, in a classified report on UFO activity, sightings of unexplained objects at great altitudes and traveling at high speeds in the vicinity of major U.S. defense installations are such nature they're not attributable to natural phenomena or known type of aerial vehicles. Well, everybody got ready for what they believed was going to happen. Later, the Intelligence Advisory Committee concurred with Chadwell and recommended that the services of selected scientists to review and appraise available evidence in the light of pertinent scientific theories should be the order of the day. So came about the Robertson Panel, named after the man chosen to head this inquiry, Howard Percy Robertson, a CIA consultant, a renowned physicist, and director of the Defense Department Weapons Evaluation Group. The overall conclusion of the panel was that while UFOs per se didn't appear to have a bearing on national security or the defense of the U.S., the way in which the subject could be used by unfriendly forces to manipulate the public mindset, disrupt the U.S. military, did have a bearing, and a major one as well, on matters of national security. According to the panel's members, although evidence for any direct threat from these sightings was wholly lacking, related dangers might well exist resulting from A, misidentification of actual enemy artifacts by defense personnel, B, overloading of emergency reporting channels with false information, and C, subjectivity of public to mass hysteria. C, while the military knows that it only reports what it sees, anybody not wearing a uniform is subject to mass hysteria. I noticed that mindset when I was on active duty. There was also a recommendation that a number of the public UFO investigative groups that existed in the U.S. at the time should be watched carefully because of the apparent irresponsibility and the possible use of such groups for subversive purposes. And they also said a public education program should be undertaken on matters relating to UFOs. Specifically, such a program would result in reduction in public interest in flying saucers. In other words, convince the public they're not seeing what they're seeing. This education should be accomplished by mass media such as television, motion pictures, and popular articles. The basis of such education will be actual case histories that have been puzzling at first but later explained. Swamp gas. Even though there's no swamp within 100 miles, it's swamp gas. As is the case of conjuring tricks, there's much less stimulation if the secret is known. In connection to this idea, Dr. Hadley Cantrell from Princeton was suggested. He wrote Invasion from Mars, a study in the psychology of panic, written about the famous Orson Welles radio broadcast in 1938, and has since performed advanced laboratory studies in the field of perception. They're also going to bring in a couple of consulting psychologists, Don Marquis from the University of Michigan and Leo Rosten. Well, is anyone familiar with mass communication techniques? Perhaps an advertising expert might be helpful. Arthur Godfrey was mentioned as possibly a valuable channel of communication reaching a mass audience. Dr. Berkner suggested the U.S. Navy Special Devices Center, Sands Point, Long Island, is a potential valuable organization to assist in its education program. Teaching techniques used by this agency for aircraft identification during the past war were cited as an example of a similar education task. The Jam Handy Company that made World War II training films was also suggested, well, as Walt Disney Incorporated animated cartoons. Well, the panel singling out of Disney made sense, given the animation giant's then firmly established work relationship with the U.S. government during World War II. Disney made numerous propaganda shorts for the military, and in the 50s, corporate and government sponsors helped the company produce films promoting President Eisenhower's Adams for Peace policy. There was the retrospectively hilarious duck and cover documentary that depicted school children surviving an atomic attack by sheltering under their desk. Of course, at the time we were going through that, I often wondered, we're under the desk, the building collapses. Is the desk going to protect us? I asked that and was told I was being annoying. Because Eisenhower said, so the Robertson panel highlighted Disney, and that fact was considered significant in that the panel's general recommendation to debunk UFOs through media channels has only been acted upon in at least one instance. The CBS TV broadcast of UFOs, Friend, Foe, or Fantasy, 1966, an anti-UFO documentary narrated by none other than Walter Cronkite. A man that everyone listened to until they realized he was full of crap. In a letter addressed to former Robertson Panel Secretary Frederick Durant, Dr. Thompson Page confided that he helped organize a CBS TV show around the Robertson Panel conclusions, even though this was 13 years after the panel that first convened. So it's clear that the the government at least attempted to follow through under Robertson Panel's Disney recommendation. As for Ward Kimball, 1979, he went public on certain aspects of Disney's links to the UFO conundrum and officialdom and stated that it wasn't just the CIA that Disney was working with when it came to UFOs. At some point during 55 or 56, Disney was contacted by representatives of the Air Force and asked to secretly cooperate on a documentary about the UFO controversy. As part of the deal, the Air Force offered to supply actual UFO footage. Now, if the UFOs don't exist, how did the Air Force have footage? Which Disney was told it could include in its film. Now, according to Kimball, at that time, it wasn't at all unusual for either Walt Disney or his studio to go along with the government's wishes. Or perhaps demands might be a far more accurate term. Kimball revealed during the Second World War, the military practically took over Disney's Burbank facilities, where dozens of hours of military training productions and war effort films created featuring Disney characters like Donald Duck, the Duckster. Students began work on the requested UFO documentary. Animators were asked to imagine what an alien would look like, while Walt Disney himself eagerly waited for the Air Force to deliver the promised film of actual UFOs. But according to Kimball, at the last moment, the Air Force mysteriously withdrew the offer of the footage and the documentary was canceled. But what this does demonstrate is that Disney had a link to UFOs, the CIA, and these secret projects, and specifically and collectively in a fashion that revolved around manipulating and controlling public opinion and perception of all things of the UFO variety. Clearly, the government, in carrying out the Robertson Panel recommendations, was fully prepared to lie to the public and did not feel any problem with that. Well, we have quite a number of I got conspiracies out the wazoo. a number of conspiracy theorists have suggested that one spinoff of the MKUltra mind control experimentation began in the early 1950s, and that was the development of a program to fabricate UFO incidents. In other words, the plan was to subject unwitting individuals to brain-warping and mind-altering technologies to see how effective they might be. And one person who was believed to have been subjected to this very technology was none other than L. Ron Hubbard, the brains behind the controversial cult of Scientology. One of the terms of the Freedom of Information Act, the FBI has declassified hundreds of pages of formerly classified files on Hubbard and the Church of Scientology. One of these documents contained a letter that Hubbard wrote to the FBI. And the topic was somewhat weird and downright disturbing. According to the FBI, Hubbard told them that on February 23, 1951, about 2 or 3 in the morning, his apartment was entered and he was knocked out. A needle was thrust into his heart to produce a coronary thrombosis and he was given an electrical shock. He said his recollection of the event was now very blurred and had no witnesses, and the only other person who had a key to the apartment was his wife. It wasn't long after this that Hubbard's belief in alien life grew to new and stratospheric proportions. Interestingly enough, in the following year, a man named Carl Hunrath from Wisconsin had a very similar experience to that of Hubbard. In July of 1952, he complained to his local police department about something very weird indeed. He said in the early hours of a Sunday morning in July, somebody broke into his home, incapacitated him, injected his arm full of chemicals that rendered him in a distinctly altered state of mind and nearly paralleled the claims of L. Ron Hubbard, and proceeded to tell him that he, Hunrath, had been chosen to play a significant role in the alien mission on Earth. A groggy Hunrath could only look on the maze from his bed as the somewhat foreign-sounding but perfectly human-appearing alien told him, "I am Bosco. You've been chosen to enter our Brotherhood of Galaxies." Now, the files continue with the suit and tie-wearing Bosco advised Hunrath the brothers from beyond were deeply worried about our warlike ways, and as a result, action had to be taken against those dastardly elements of the human race who wanted to spoil everybody's fun. Now, this wasn't going to be any day the earth stood still type stuff. The aliens wished to recruit sympathetic humans to aid in their righteous cause. Hunrath, like Hubbard, developed an interest in UFOs that quickly became an obsession. On November 10, 1953, Hunrath, with a colleague named Wilbur Wilkinson, vanished. They took to the skies in a small two-seater plane from a small airport on the outskirts of L.A. Neither man was ever seen again. In late July 1953, just 4 months before he vanished, Hunrath booked a flight from L.A. back to his home state of Wisconsin. After a brief stop in his hometown of Racine, he drove to the approximately 50-mile journey to the city of Delavan, where he met with Kenneth Goff, man who was born there in 1914 and spent his formative years growing up there as well. Goff is described in now declassified FBI files of May 6, 1955 as a self-styled freelance evangelist who for the past number of years has been speaking around the U.S. regarding the threat of communism to the U.S. Lectures that Goff routinely delivered to interested parties included treason in our State Department, should we use the atom bomb, Red secret plot for Caesar of Denver, and the Reds plan to come by Alaska. Well, as the FBI noted in the file, also some of the titles of Goff's books, which he publishes voluminously, are Russia Invade America, One World, A Red World, and Confessions of Stalin's Agent. Well, the FBI had additional concerns with Mr. Goff. Seems he'd once been a rabid commie himself, and there were certain figures in the Bureau who believed he wasn't quite the now anti-communist he professed to be. Rather, there was a suspicion Goff had gone deep cover and his red-hating ravings were merely a collective ingenious ruse to camouflage his real intent. Establishing networks of communist sympathizers across the U.S. Now, in this file the FBI released, they had a massive information on Goff. Number one is a self-admitted former member of the Communist Party. Was found guilty by jury trial in February 25, 1948 in the United States District Court for the District of Columbia and fined $100 as a result of the subject placing anti-communist signs in front of the Soviet embassy in Washington. That had to be annoying. The file also stated the Rocky Mountain News on November 25, 1951 contained an article stating that three Inglewood persons were ordered to appear in Denver Municipal Court as an aftermath of the ripping of the Soviet flag yesterday at Civic Center. Mr. and Mrs. Kenneth Goff were two of the three individuals. So, was he a committed communist? Or was he an anti-communist? Patriotic Americans might say that protesting outside the Soviet embassy and tearing up the Soviet flag were very laudable actions for a U.S. citizen to undertake on home turf at the height of the Cold War. The FBI, though, wasn't so certain. They said it's been our concern that Goff always ensures he's seen while displaying anti-Soviet tendencies. It was observed that if Goff is still privately of a party mind, this might explain his public displays. He was certainly an interesting character and made comments in the 50s about communist-based plans to covertly introduce fluoride into the U.S. water supply. We did that ourselves. It was going to create a spirit of lethargy in the nation. Had a deep interest in flying saucers. In fact, one of his regular lectures was titled Traitors in the Pulpit, or What's Behind the Flying Saucers? Are they from Russia? Another planet or God? It wasn't so much from the perspective of UFOs being alien or even Russian, though, that interested Goff. His concern was how the UFO subject could be utilized as a tool of manipulation and control by the government. In his 1959 publication, Red Shadows, he offered the following to his readers, which of course included the FBI. In the past few years, the flying saucer scare has rapidly become one of the main issues used by organizations working for a one-world government to frighten people into the belief we'll need a super-world government to cope with an invasion from another planet. Many means are being used to create a vast amount of imagination in the minds of the general public concerning the possibilities of an invasion by strange creatures from Mars or Venus. This drive, he said, began in the early 40s with a radio drama put on by Orson Welles, which caused panic in many of the larger cities of the East and resulted in the death of several people. The Orson Welles program of invasion from Mars was used by the Communist Party as a test to find out how the people would react on instructions given out over the radio. It was an important part of the Communist rehearsal for the revolution. Well, this now infamous Welles broadcast was based on H.G. Wells' novel, War of the Worlds. And while today it's fashionable and almost de rigueur within the UFO circles to suggest the conspiratorial and nefarious aspects of Orson Welles' broadcast and deep conspiracy go together hand in hand, it was far less so in the 50s. Goffman was quite the prophet, and particularly so when one takes into consideration the fact he'd been mouthing off about War of the Worlds, a one-world government, and a secret program to manipulate the public with the staged UFO encounters as far back as 1951. Why 1951, you ask? Well, this is where things get kind of strange. In that very year, Goff, just like L. Ron Hubbard in 51 and Carl Hunrath in 52, got a visit in the middle of the night from a shadowy character who pumped his arm full of mind-expanding drugs. in practically the same scenario that befell Hunrath and L. Ron Hubbard, a smartly dressed human-looking alien did appear before the astonished Goff. As one who wished Goff to spread the word that A, communism was a bad thing, and B, E.T. hated the Reds. Now, Goff might have been an odd character, but he was certainly no fool. After the strange figure vanished and Goff finally regained his senses, he recognized it simply could not have been a coincidence that he, with a fairly significant background in matters of red nature, should have been warned about the perils of communism. Well, couple this with his well-publicized fears about chemicals being introduced into the water supply to affect the mindset of the American public, Goff came to believe he'd been targeted by some governmental agency that had at its heart a program involving the creation of fabricated UFO-themed events, the use of drugs to instill altered states in the targeted individual, and a bigger picture of widespread manipulation and control of the population via hoaxed UFO events, hence his absolute obsession with the whole War of the Worlds, One World Government issue. Now, the Goff-Hubbard link didn't begin and end with late-night shenanigans in the bedroom and needles in the arm. In 1955, the Church of Scientology published a booklet titled Brainwashing, a Synthesis of the Russian Textbook on Psychopolitics. Supposedly, it was a summary of the work of one Lavrentiy Beria, a Soviet politician, Marshal of the Soviet Union, and Chief of the Soviet Security and Secret Police Apparatus under Stalin during the Second World War, and Deputy Premier from 46 to 53. According to the Church of Scientology, brainwashing was distilled from a lengthy speech that Beria delivered in 1950 on the subject of none other than how psychiatry could be utilized as a tool of social control. Not everybody, though, was quite so sure Beria had anything to do with it. L. Ron Hubbard Jr. came straight to the point and said, Dad wrote every word of it. Even more interesting, the introduction of a version of brainwashing in the hands of Morris Kaminsky, the author of The Hoaxers, Plain Liars, Fancy Liars, and Damn Liars, was written by none other than Kenneth Goff. Another version attributes the entire work to Goff, despite the fact that the documents filled with what's clearly evidence of Hubbard's very own writing style and references to Dianetics. So it would appear that Goff and Hubbard were somehow interconnected. Goff died in 1972, still in his late 50s. Given that Hubbard, Goff, and Hunrath were all subjected to nighttime visitations from individuals who injected them with chemicals of who knows what kind, and that all three men subsequently became well-known players within the arena of UFO research, this begs an important question. Are shadowy forces who agend us to roll in a new world order intent on using a non-existing alien threat to control us, just as Kenneth Goff believed was going to happen one day? Certainly, it does raise interesting questions. Well, there have been a number of studies authorized by the government in regard to UFOs. In the December of 1960, January 1961 issue of the NICAP UFO Investigator Journal, a small article was published under the heading of Space Life Report Could Be Shock. According to this article, the discovery of intelligent space beings could be a severe effect or have a severe effect on the public, according to a research report released by the National Aeronautics and Space Administration. The report warned that America should prepare to meet the psychological impact of such a revelation. The 190-page report that it referenced was the result of a $96,000 one-year study conducted by the Brookings Institute for NASA's Long-Range Study Committee. It was found that public realization that an intelligent being lives on another planet could bring about profound changes, even the collapse of our civilization. Societies share their own place have disintegrated when confronted by superior society, according to the report. Others have survived, even though changed. Clearly, the better we can come to understand the factors involved in responding to such cases, the better prepared we may be. And although the research group didn't expect any immediate contact with other planetary beings, it said that the discovery of intelligent space races could nevertheless happen at any time. Now, that was 1961. Raises some interesting questions. This Brookings Institute report has been the basis of quite a number of government policies. And it's believed it was also one of the basis for passing the federal law in the 70s that made it a federal crime to come in contact with either the UFO or its occupants, even though they said the UFO and its occupants don't exist, still. If you come in contact with non-existent UFOs, there is a problem. Well, yeah, somebody asked me the other day, did I have any proof that the U.S. government experimented on its citizens? Now, I was there when they took us at gunpoint to inoculation stations to be inoculated against the swine flu. A number of people had reactions. Nobody I knew died, but I did hear through the grapevine that a number of people had become very ill and had to be hospitalized. In the swine flu epidemic we had been warned about, didn't come to pass. But there is evidence that for at least 80 years, the Department of Defense has used hundreds of thousands of military personnel and private citizens in experiments with mustard nerve gas, ionizing radiation, psychochemicals, hallucinogens, and just basic drugs. So I put together a list of some of these secret programs. I'm sure there are many more that I don't have on the list. 1931, the Rockefeller Institute for Medical Investigations infected human subjects with cancer. Now, what did Jack Ruby swear he'd been infected with? Cancer cells. And a number of UFO investigators, as I've talked about in previous shows, have died of very fast spreading cancer that just seemed to happen literally overnight. Dr. Cornelius Rhodes established U.S. Army biological warfare facilities in Maryland, Utah, and Panama and began a series of radiation exposure experiments on patients in government and civilian hospitals. When I was in Panama, I've always been interested in conspiracies, so, you know, I listened. And even in the 70s, I was hearing discussions about facilities deep in the jungle where experiments were taking place. 1932, there was a Tuskegee syphilis study. A ton of black men diagnosed with syphilis were never told of their illness and used as human guinea pigs in order to better understand the symptoms of the disease. Only 74 survived. None of them got any treatment for their condition. 1935, millions had died of pellagra, a dietary deficiency, in poverty-stricken black populations. U.S. Public Health Service finally acted to curb the disease and admitted it had known the causes of pellagra for more than 20 years, but did nothing about it. 1940, in order to gauge the abilities of experimental drugs designed to fight malaria, 400 prisoners in Chicago were infected with the disease, and this progression was studied. 1942, 4,000 servicemen, mostly Seventh-day Adventists who were conscientious objectors, served as human guinea pigs for mustard gas experiments. Now, I accidentally caught a whiff of that. Let me tell you, that's something you do not want. In 1946, World War II veterans recovering from wartime wounds in Veterans Administration hospitals were quietly used as subjects in medical studies and experiments. A number died. 1947, the U.S. Atomic Energy Commission began administering intravenous doses of radioactive materials to human subjects with the type of results you might expect. 1947, in its efforts to evaluate LSD as a potential weapon or truth serum, the CIA administered dosages of this hallucinogenic drug to human subjects, civilian and military, often without their knowledge or consent. In fact, what brought it to light was they drugged one of their own scientists who walked out a window of a hotel where they were having a party. 1950, with nuclear weapons still in their infancy, Department of Defense detonated nuclear devices in desert areas and monitored unsuspecting civilians in cities downwind of the blast for medical problems and mortality rates. Allegedly, that's what led to the death of Clark Gable, John Wayne, and several other actors who were making Western films downwind of the test site. Also in 1950, the U.S. Navy sprayed a cloud of bacteria over San Francisco to test how a large city would respond to more lethal biological attacks. This was a pneumonia-like inducing bacteria, and quite a number of residents became very ill. I didn't find any reports of deaths, but a lot of people became very ill. 1955, in an experiment to test its ability to infect human populations with biological agents, CIA released bacteria in the Tampa, Florida area. 1956, mosquitoes infected with yellow fever were released over Savannah, Georgia, and Avon Park, Florida. U.S. Army disease specialists posing as public health officials tested area residents for the effects of these mosquitoes. Now you may think, so a mosquito bites you and you get yellow fever, so what? In Panama, in the building of the Panama Canal, yellow fever literally wiped out the French effort. In 1965, dioxin. Inmates at Holmesburg State Prison in Philadelphia were dosed with dioxin, the toxic chemical component of Agent Orange used in Vietnam. They were studied for the effects. Dioxin can even have genetic effects for future generations. 1966, more than 1 million civilians were exposed to germ warfare when U.S. Army scientists dropped light bulbs filled with bacteria in the ventilation grates throughout the New York City subway system. Number of people, large number of people, became ill. 1977, Senate hearings revealed that between 49 and 69 and over 239 highly populated areas, including San Francisco, Washington, D.C., Key West, Panama City, Florida, Minneapolis, and St. Louis have been contaminated with biological agents. Centers for Disease Control asked specifically for promiscuous homosexual males when it tested an experimental hepatitis B vaccine in New York, L.A., and San Francisco. 3 years later, in these same cities, the first cases of AIDS were confirmed in homosexual men. The CDC inoculated more than 1,500 six-month-old black and Hispanic babies in L.A. against measles. The center later confessed that the vaccine was experimental. 1995, evidence surfaced that biological agents used during the Gulf War had been manufactured in Houston, Texas, and Boca Raton, Florida, and tested on prisoners in the Texas Department of Corrections. And that's just up through 95. It boggles the mind that our own government uses citizens as guinea pigs. Well, I met the a number of people at various events who had a large number of theories to present, and certainly some of them were absolutely mind-boggling. And these weren't wide-eyed lunatics. These were people who had done their research. They were able to respond to questions. One of those involved in Waco. You know, there's some really strange people who have stayed under the radar, so to speak. One of those was a strange man right out of the Twilight Zone who devoted his life in an attempt to reverse the results of World War II and declared the Third Reich the winner. His name was Francis Parker Yoakie. And if he hadn't committed suicide in 1960 when the FBI caught him, he would have been pleased with the violent and chaotic manner in which world events have progressed since 9/11. He would have delighted in the collapse of the World Trade Center and rejoiced that Islamic extremists have been the perpetrators of the terrorist act. Dedicated his life to reversing the outcome of World War II, a mission he thought he could accomplish by 2050. He provided covert assistance to organize Muslim opposition to the West and hoped that terrorists whom surrender was impossible began attacking American cities. He envisioned a world in which America's global influence would be replaced by a European superstate built on the precepts of Hitler's Third Reich and ruled by elitists who'd replace Christianity with the occult hermetic disciplines. Now, there's not a great deal known about this guy. It's just devotees of weird tales embrace the mystery of H.P. Lovecraft's Necronomicon. Disciples of fascism and Satanism were devoted to Yoxie's underground text, Imperium. Of course, followers of Lovecraft's work understood that the world of ancient ones he created was fiction. Admirers of Yoakie's work dedicated themselves to fulfilling his vision of European unity under a Nazi regime. Now, he brushed aside the defeat in World War II as a temporary setback in the march toward the ultimate goal of the exclusion of America and European affairs and a fascist revolution in America itself. Imperium was written under the pseudonym of Ulrich Varang. Ulrich, supposedly a Danish-Irish name, Varang, a reference to the Norsemen. And it was self-published in 1948 by Yoakie in a limited edition of 200 copies. Reprints of this work circulate today among neo-Nazis and far-right groups who regard his thoughts and theories with the same reverence that earlier like-minded readers hail for Hitler's Mein Kampf. Now, it wasn't until some years after his death that radical right publisher Willis Carto published a paperback edition of Imperium, and the book began to reach a wide readership among neo-Nazi and neo-fascist groups. The Italian hermetic ideologue Giulio Scivola had praised Yoki's work, and Imperium was in harmony with the Swiss-based New European Order and its beliefs in the myth of Aryan origins and the Hyperborean North and in Atlantis. Well, some researchers are certain that Yoki was part of a German-American espionage network, and he aided infiltration of Nazi saboteurs into the United States. Now, during World War II, of all things, he got a commission in the United States Army. He then briefly deserted, but after a few weeks returned to duty and satisfied the Army had suffered a mental breakdown. Got a medical discharge without any suspicion he may have been aiding Nazi spies and saboteurs during his time away from base. Before the war, he pursued an academic career at several universities, got a law degree at Notre Dame, and was qualified to practice. Also attended Georgetown University School of Foreign Service as an undergraduate. And with these qualifications, he obtained a job after the war with the War Crimes Tribunal in Germany. As you might guess, he was discharged because he tended to side with the Nazi officials he was supposed to be prosecuting. Later got a job with the American Red Cross and returned to Germany. Deserted again and went back to the U.S. He had used both positions as a means to get the U.S. government to pay for his trips to Germany to meet with the growing pan-European fascist network. Conspiracy theorists speculate he spent the 50s accumulating a bewildering array of identities as he traveled literally around the world, doing whatever he could to aid the fascist cause. 1960, the FBI confronted him in Oakland when his numerous identities and passports raised a number of red flags. Before agents could question him, he tried to run away and injuring an agent in the process. On June 17, 1960, he took potassium cyanide and killed himself rather than answer questions. But it does raise some interesting observations. Many of the same people who follow his Imperium theory are involved in the UFO movement. I don't know there's a connection, but I just find that very interesting. When you look into some of the really strange theories out there, quite often, when you look behind the scenes, so to speak, you discover you can't dismiss the theories, no matter how crazy they are, because each one has a modicum of truth. You know, the study of conspiracies is literally fascinating because you find out things you never dreamed could possibly be true. For example, the B-25 ghost bomber that I talked about. It was a Mitchell bomber, one of World War II's most famous warplanes. January 31st, 1956, the B-25 ditched into the Monongahela River near Pittsburgh and vanished. Even when dredging operations were done to find the plane, they couldn't. And of course, the government didn't want to admit what the cargo was, and that raised even more suspicion. But there's no question the bomber went into the river. There were a number of witnesses who saw it. Well, nobody can stop the clock, and it is ticking down. Tonight's show will soon be one for the ages, so to speak. You know, one of the best known party places on the planet is Bohemian Grove. Sealed off by black helicopters and the private security force. Once a year, the elite gather there to perform major acts of debauchery while they allegedly plan the fate of the world. Some 2,500 of the world's wealthiest, most influential, and most powerful men meet there each year for 17 days in a private 2,700-acre retreat on the Russian River in Sonoma County, California. The decisions made there shape international policies and influence people throughout the world. Membership role of this elitist group kept in strictest confidence, but include super wealthy, blood dynasty family members of the Illuminati, corporate chieftains, and high government officials. According to a number of conspiracy theorists and several fundamentalist Christian evangelical ministers, one might find among the rich and politically powerful gentlemen cavorting about in the Bohemian Grove, former U.S. presidents, Supreme Court justices, former Secretary of Defense, mayor of L.A., San Francisco, and other major cities, former astronauts, former FBI and CIA directors, former secretaries of state, many of the world's media chieftains, but of course, no mainstream media outlet will report on what goes on there. Well, we've come to the end of another show, and I hope you enjoyed it. I'm always looking for ideas for new shows, so if you got one, just send me an email, you know, or call the show, 267-521-0159. And it works because I've had a number of callers. Last night's callers were a bit on the wacko side and didn't realize that when they call in, my system gives me their phone number and where they're at. So until tomorrow night at 6, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show saying have a truly great evening. Thank you.